Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Since when do you ask, man? Since when do you ask?
It's polite, though.
It is polite. Hey, everybody. Kai Rosendahl. It is Tuesday. Make Me Smart. Deep dive into a single topic about which today I'm really actually totally psyched about because I don't know a lot
so
about it. It's amazing history. It's just so awesome. And we're going to dig in with somebody who really knows it. Anyway, Kimberly Adams is here because Molly Wood is, I don't know where she is, up in the mountains somewhere. Hi, Kimberly.
Stargazing.
That's right.
She's stargazing. Well, comet gazing, actually. Yeah. But yes, I'm so excited for this conversation as well. As many of you know, the Supreme Court ruled 5-4, affirming that a huge section of land in eastern Oklahoma is indeed an American Indian reservation, including much of the city of Tulsa. This land has been a reservation since the Trail of Tears in the 1830s, when thousands of Native people were forcibly removed from their homeland. But over the years, the U.S. government has eroded those legal protections. Sections of the land have been sold off. And now the Supreme Court has stepped in to say, hey, we actually have to stick to our treaty obligations. And this is Native land after all.
Rebecca Nagel is on the other end of the phone today. She's an independent journalist. She's been covering this story for years and all of its ramifications in all kinds of outlets. Also in a podcast called This Land from Crooked Media, which I endorse. She is also a member of the Cherokee Nation. Rebecca, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what does this, just to like really get it down to the person, what does it mean to you that this case came the way it did?
You know, I think like a lot of folks watching this decision, you know, I knew that the law was on the side of Muscogee Creek Nation, but I didn't know which way the Supreme Court was actually going to rule. Mm-hmm. And I woke up Thursday morning actually filled with dread that that it wasn't going to go our way. And then when I clicked on the decision, the first thing I did was look to see who wrote it. And when I saw that it was Gorsuch, I started screaming, honestly, and then crying. And there were a lot of emotions. And so I think that, you know, our tribes here in eastern Oklahoma, you know, Muscogee Creek Nation was at the center of the case, and it also impacts Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, and Seminoles. You know, we've always held that this land was a reservation. And so Thursday didn't bring news to our tribes, but it brought, you know, affirmation and one of those very rare moments of justice where I think for centuries the United States has created a system of laws that at the same time, you know, gives the United States actually a lot of power to step on tribal sovereignty and to step on indigenous rights. But those laws also, you know, I think because of the work of our ancestors, carve out space for our tribes to still have land, government, language, and citizens. But so often the United States doesn't follow its own laws, right? And so, you know, this is one of those rare moments where in an uncompromising way, that's what the Supreme Court did. It followed the law.
Now, we've been talking a lot about sort of what the outcome is, but can you just sort of condense for people what this case was about and why it has the ramifications that it does?
Yeah, so there were two separate cases that the Supreme Court heard that asked the same question, which is, does Muscogee Creek Nation still have a reservation? Both cases were brought by Native men who had been prosecuted by the state of Oklahoma and convicted of crimes that occurred within the treaty territories of Muscogee Creek Nation. And so that question went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has a well-established and pretty straightforward test to decide whether or not a reservation still exists. And there are different components to the test, but it basically boils down to one simple question, which is, did Congress ever pass a law that disestablished the reservation? You know, we're used to when Congress wants to do something, you know, it puts it in writing. that's kind of how we think about legislation working. But somehow, you know, I think Oklahoma and the federal government argued that in this case, things were more complicated, that even though Congress never explicitly disestablished Muscogee Creek Nation's reservation, that's what they intended to do. That was the basic question that was presented by the case.
The root of this case is a treaty from the 1830s that your like four times great-grandfather signed, right? Do I have that right?
Yes. My great-great-great-great-grandfather and my great-great-great-grandfather, father and son, John Ridge, and some other members of my family, like Elias Boutenan and Stan Waite. It was a controversial treaty. The Treaty of New Echota was signed at a time when many Cherokees and the official Cherokee government actually opposed the idea of moving west. And a group of Cherokees called the Treaty Party signed that treaty with the idea that moving here is what would keep our nation intact. Sort of the other thing that was on the table was that Cherokees would stay in the East, but kind of be absorbed, become United States citizens, and would no longer be a sovereign tribe. And for them, I think the difficult choice that they made, knowing that it was unpopular and knowing that they would actually be killed for it, which is what happened, right, was that what was most important was maintaining the sovereignty of our tribe. And so that treaty was the first of numerous that established the land rights here in what is present-day Oklahoma. For Cherokee Nation, you know, while that land base was made smaller by subsequent treaties, it was also affirmed by those treaties. And then all five tribes here in eastern Oklahoma have a similar history of going through the Trail of Tears and being promised that when they arrived in this new land west of the Mississippi, that land would be theirs forever. And then what we have seen is that promise, you know, was completely run over through this process called allotment to create the state of Oklahoma. That promise was then ignored and brushed aside by the state and at times the federal government for over a century. And on Thursday, you know, the court said that promise means something, you know, not just symbolically and not just morally, but legally, you know, and that we are going to follow the law set aside in that treaty.
So what are the legal ramifications of this? Obviously, there's a criminal law effect for these two particular cases, but what else does it mean?
I mean, I think, you know, right after the Supreme Court made its decision, there are a few questions immediately about what it meant. And so I think the first was whether it applies just to Muscogee Creek Nation or if it applies to all five tribes. And I think it's important to be clear that Justice Gorsuch, in the way that he wrote his opinion, he asked and answered that question and said, you know, the question before us as a court is about the treaty territory of Muscogee Creek Nation, and that's what we're answering. But what you saw after the decision was issued almost immediately is all five tribes and the Attorney General of Oklahoma issuing separate and joint statements. And so everyone here kind of on the ground in Oklahoma is interpreting it as applying to all five tribes. And so that's a land area that's about 40% of the land in the state. It's about 19 million acres. And so it's significant.
It's like 1.8 million people live there.
Yeah, so I think it's significant in terms of indigenous land rights. You know, prior to Thursday, the amount of land that the BIA recognized as reservation land was 55 million acres. And as of Thursday, that number rose to 74 million. So I think that's a really important victory for tribes. Now, what it means on the ground, I think a lot of people have this idea, and definitely, you know, Oklahoma during arguments was kind of, I think, a little bit like Chicken Little. And I think now that the decision has been made and it's being implemented, we're going to see that actually the sky is not falling down. So specifically what happens is that for certain crimes, if the person being accused of the crime or if the victim is Native, those crimes, rather than being tried in state court, will be tried either in tribal or federal court. I don't think you have to think too hard about what the solution would be for one court system to have fewer cases and a couple other court systems, or more than one because there's more than one tribe, but for other court systems to have more cases, you know. And I think one of the things that people fail to realize is that here on the ground in Oklahoma, the state and the tribes have a long history of working together. And especially in rural areas of Oklahoma, it's a lot of times the tribes that are actually providing those kind of basic governmental services. And so whether it's paving a road or Lane water line so that people in rural areas have access to drinking water, or providing healthcare, you know, drive-in COVID testing, things like that. You know, Muscogee Creek Nation, there were two hospitals and one outpatient center that within their reservation were being closed because rural healthcare in Oklahoma has been really struggling. And the tribe stepped in and kept those health facilities open, not just to tribal citizens, but to the public, because they didn't want anyone living within their community to have to drive an hour to get to an emergency room. And so I think that a lot of what is going to happen as a result of this case is what has already been happening in Oklahoma, which is that tribes are going to continue to work with both the state and local governments.
You wrote about this case in the Washington Post. Sorry, let me scroll up to find the date. November 2018. One of the things you said, you talked about, was how Cherokee and Native Americans writ large have been losing land for a very long time. Most of the loss happened in earlier centuries, but you say we are still bleeding. In other words, every time, you know, somebody marries outside the tribe, you know, you lose land, all of that. Or you could lose land, all of those things. Do you think this case has stopped the bleeding?
Absolutely. And so under Oklahoma's version of the law, the only land within our treaty territories that was technically what we would still call Indian country or Indian land was what are called restricted allotments. So that means that the descendant of the person, so let me back up. So up until Oklahoma became a state, tribes owned our land in the former Indian territory communally. And so you could build a house, you could build a farm, but all the land belonged to the tribe. So like all the land within Muscogee Creek Nation belonged to Muscogee Creek Nation. And then that land was privatized and it lost its Indian character if it was sold, which could include even, you know, the bank owning it, so you could get a mortgage to build a house. Up until a couple years ago, if the landowner was less than half blood quantum, considered Indian by their Indian pedigree, it lost that Indian character. You could be passing it on to your children and not follow, basically file the right paperwork during that inheritance process, and it would lose its Indian character. And so I know for Cherokee Nation, after that policy of a century, only 2% of our land was still considered Indian country prior to this decision. And so that system of laws, that allotment set in place, was still operating and still doing, you know, basically what it was designed to do. And so I think that that's one of the things that's really important about this case, is that it puts a stop on that century of bleeding out Indian land.
You gave an example in your podcast about regulations and how in the case of all of these chicken plants in one particular community, people were going and Native people were going and trying to get the state to basically do more regulations on these chicken processing facilities. And on a fundamental level, does this case matter for things like that, for state regulations, for taxing, and for all of these other questions about, you know, the fundamentals of who runs a community?
So I think that those are some of the big questions that haven't been answered yet. So I think people right now are sorting out criminal jurisdiction and what happens in the courts and what happens with prosecution. I think that there are cases that talk about taxation. And so typically, if you are a citizen of a tribe and you live on your tribe's land and you work for your tribe, and so for our citizens, that would include people who work for our tribal government and also our businesses, that you're not supposed to pay state income tax. And so people would still pay federal income tax, but not state income tax. So I think that's something that we'll see how that gets sorted out. And then I think the question of environmental regulation looms very large, especially in a state like Oklahoma, who has like one of the most, you know, we've got very, very, very lax rules. And I think actually what's happened with the chicken houses is a really good example where, you know, the boards that govern things like clean water and drinking water and all these things are sort of just giving all of these permits to these chicken house operators without the type of review that you would think that kind of institution would do. And so how much authority this is going to give the tribes, I think actually remains to be determined. And so I think it depends on how much pushback there is from the state. It might be, you know, we'll see. Maybe it'll be decided by agreements. It might, there might be subsequent litigation. I think that it's going to take a minute for all of those things to get sorted out on the ground.
Rebecca Nagle is a journalist, a podcaster as well. This Land is the name of the podcast. I do recommend it highly. Also a member of the Cherokee Nation. Rebecca, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
Thank you so much for having me.
Such an interesting time.
Yeah.
You know, I spent a lot of time listening to her podcast and about sort of just like this long struggle to get the recognition of this. And I can't imagine what that must feel like at this particular moment.
Yeah. I'm gonna plug that podcast one more time because it's just cool. It's called This Land, Crooked Media, Rebecca Nagle. Check it out. Send us your thoughts, your comments, questions, whatever you like. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. Voice memos, emails, we'll take them all. And we're coming back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
Boom, we're back. Okay, what do you like? You go first.
I feel bad. All my news fixes are probably going to be downers, but there was this really fascinating.
Have you read the news lately? I don't think there's any good news.
My sister calls it like a parade of horrible.
Yeah.
And she's like, every time I watch the news, it's a parade of horrible. But there was, in today's parade of horrible, this very fascinating deep dive from ProPublica, which does pretty much all deep dives, this big investigation of a teenager in Michigan who got sent to jail for not doing her homework. Like, for real.
Insane.
Like, actually, so she was on probation for, I think, an assault charge or something like that. And apparently her not doing her online remote learning homework was a violation of her probation. And it was up to these local juvenile court judges to decide how to, you know, determine how to weigh whether or not in the midst of the pandemic a child should go back into custody. And they decided, this particular judge, Mary Ellen Brennan, decided that this young lady not doing her homework was a violation of her probation, and she went into detention for it. And I don't really know what to say about that.
Well, did you say, and maybe I missed it, that she's a black child? Right, she's a 15-year-old black girl.
Yes,
that seems relevant, right? I mean, yeah.
I mean, I think the fact that it's a child in a pandemic,
well, yeah,
in general,
or, yeah, fair enough. But still, right?
But yes, it does get to this sort of like over policing of black children and harsher sentences for black children, and the fact that, you know, Black kids are disciplined more, are incarcerated more, are considered to be more adult than they are, and all these things. There's a sad anecdote in this story about her mom trying to go and visit her in this facility, and she tried to go to see her, wasn't able to, and instead got back the bag of clothes and other things that she had brought for her daughter on a previous visit that they didn't give to her because the underwear wasn't the right type and the jeans were too tight and a couple of other things. And it's a pretty heartbreaking story. And it's worth reading. It's a really depressing picture of what's happening. But there you go. That's my news fix.
There you go. We'll have it in the show notes. It's also on ProPublica. Look, I mean, the news is what the news is. Mine is equally dire, not as perhaps downbeat, but Sarah Cliff, who does health policy for the New York Times, she's been on Marketplace a bunch of times, super, super good reporter on this topic, had a piece about the technology of coronavirus testing. And apparently in Harris County, Texas, they are dependent on fax machines to relay test results. And it is, to me, just bonkers that here we are in a crisis that is moving so quickly we can't even trace it, that we have to figure out how to negotiate fax machines to transmit critical healthcare records. I will also point out that Anthony Fauci, who we all know who he is quoted in the Financial Times the other day as saying local healthcare is in tatters, and this is some slice of it. And I just think it's a really distressing reality check on how we're fighting this virus, which is to say, with like one hand tied behind our backs and the other one holding our mask that we're not wearing on our faces, you know?
Or tucking it gently below our chin.
Below our chin.
It reminds me of this story that we did earlier in the pandemic about why all of these unemployment insurance systems were buckling because they're hosted on this computer system that is everybody who knows how to operate this programming language, COBOL, is like in their 80s or, you know, not not in this world any longer really working on it. And this is just highlighting so many problems with our infrastructure that all need money to fix while, as I often talk about, state and federal tax revenues are down. And yay. Yay.
Yep.
All right. It's time for the mailbag, right?
It is.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
All right, so we had Scott Galloway from New York University on the program a couple of weeks ago talking about higher education. Still getting comments on that one. Here's one from Nicole Chapman. She is in Bethesda, Maryland.
Hi, Make Me Smart team. I just finished my second year as an engineering student at Virginia Tech, and after considerable consideration, I've decided that I simply cannot justify paying out-of-state tuition for Zoom school. But then that begs the question, what are we all going to do now? We're all trying to look for internships or co-ops, but we're told that things are too unstable and companies really aren't looking to hire now, especially not inexperienced kids halfway through college. What about students who are on scholarships, whose funding might be in jeopardy if they choose to take a semester off? And then won't we all just be graduating a year or two later? Will the number of students graduating be decreased for the next couple of years and then inundated, creating more competition for the same number of jobs? I guess there's no right answer to any of these questions, but I can't imagine I'm the only one asking. Thanks for listening and for the podcast.
Yeah, no, you're totally not the only one asking. I've got a family member who's taken leave from NYU this coming semester. I got DM'd from a UCLA. He's a rising junior, lives in Utah, so he's paying out-of-state tuition at UCLA, which is not cheap. And he said, I'm not going back. It's just not worth it. I'm going to take local community college courses, figure out a way to transfer them, and then go back when everything is real again. And this thing that Nicole talks about the bulge in the boa constrictor or whatever that's coming in 2-3 years when all these kids hit the job market late and they're all sort of delayed but looking for stuff at the same time, it's going to be amazing. It's going to be really, really bad.
Or even all the people looking for work now. I mean, I sometimes have young journalists like reach out to me and just say, hey, this is a tough job market. What do you suggest I do? And I'm just like,
That's a Sunday night call with my 21-year-old kid who just graduated from college. So how's it going out there with the job search? Oh, it's fine.
Oof. Oof.
Yeah, for sure.
No good answers for that one. Sorry. Sure. Moving on. Yes. Last Monday, you guys were talking about airlines.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you were talking about the interview with United Airlines CEO Scott Kirby, where he was unapologetic about selling tickets for the middle seat on airplanes. Listener Kyle McKelly, I'm sorry, Kyle, wanted to chime in on that. Here's what Kyle said.
This is Kyle from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I've heard a lot of discussion in this pandemic about de-risking. Outside is better than inside. Mask is better than no mask, yada, yada. To me, just because you can't completely maintain the 6-foot social distancing doesn't mean you should pack people in like sardines. Look, when I go to Target, I may pass people in the aisles at less than 6 feet, but that doesn't mean I gather customers and staff into a huddle and ask them to cough on me. Kirby can brag all he wants about enhanced cleaning measures, but all the cleaning in the world won't help me if I'm breathing my infected neighbor's breath. On top of that, filling the middle seats means as many as 50% more potentially infected people bringing the virus onto the plane. If they want to charge a safety premium on tickets, that's fair. But for me, packing the plane like a cattle car during a pandemic is just too high of a risk.
So I'm guessing Kyle's not going to be flying on United.
Yeah, Kyle's not going to be flying. Would you fly right now?
No. I flew earlier in the pandemic and to go see my mother, and it was terrifying. And we had all these safety protocols and all these things that we did to try to keep it as safe as possible, but it is not something that I'm going to be doing voluntarily for a while.
Same.
You?
Same.
Yeah.
No. And look, I miss it. I want to go somewhere. Forget just getting out of my house. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to New York or Washington or Portland or like Rome, you know.
I want to go to Puerto Rico.
There you go.
Beach.
Yeah, I just want to go somewhere, man. Oof.
But no. And I recognize that there's consequences of that, that there are a lot mm-hmm. of communities that rely on tourism and travel and on people braving planes. There are tens of thousands of people working in the airline industry who need us to fly to keep their jobs. And that's sort of the ongoing struggle of your own personal decisions of what mm-hmm. you need to do to stay safe versus what you know that's doing to the economy. And you know, nobody else can make that decision for another person except for wear a mask, please, for the love of God.
Everybody, just wear a mask. It's not hard. All right.
That's all I got.
We're done, right?
Yeah.
We're done.
Yeah.
We're done.
All right.
Sign up for the newsletter, MakeMeSmartNewsletter at marketplace.org/newsletters. Back tomorrow with What Do You Want to Know Wednesday. Questions, once again, MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. We're back tomorrow.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Digital producer is Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is the video producer. And Ethan Peretz is our video intern. And thank you to writer and producer Erica Phillips.
Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad, although I think it's actually Daniel Ramirez down the other end of the line. Could be wrong,
Daniel,
but either
I'm
one of those guys
wrong.
Do a bang-up job. Garrett Lang mixed it in post, as they say. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tholiday and Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand, senior producing this week as well, Sitar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. There you go. Another show in the can.
Yeah, I'm going to try really hard to find a not dismal news fix tomorrow.
You're off the hook tomorrow because What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? So think about Thursday.
Oh, okay. Thursday then. What do you know?
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.